My guest is singer Joan Baez. She was at the forefront of the folk revival during the 60s and 70s. Actually, by 1958, she performed at the Newport Folk Festival when she was 18 years old. Baez began her career singing traditional ballads, like this one, Silver Dagger.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side. Says that I can't be your bride.
Although Baez continued to sing traditional songs, she began singing more contemporary compositions, including many by her good friend Bob Dylan. Her repertoire also became very political as she took an active role in the civil rights and anti-war movements. Baez later became internationally famous for her peace activism. In 1979, she founded Humanitas International Human Rights Committee, a group she's now president of. Joan Baez has written an autobiography. It's titled And a Voice to Sing With. It's just been published by Summit Books. Joan Baez, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And I should mention you're joining us from the NPR Chicago studio as we speak now.
That's right.
One of the things I found very amusing in your book was the realization that you were actually introduced to folk music by records of the Kingston Trio.
That was one of the introductions. And when, of course, I began singing purist songs in the purest style, etc., then I had to hide all my Kingston Trio albums at the back of the rack, although I always played them.
I thought that was great. You became a bohemian at a pretty young age. What was the appeal of that kind of lifestyle to you?
Well, I don't know that I considered myself a bohemian. I just didn't wear shoes. And coming out of your average teenage identity crisis, not knowing who or what I was, when somebody labeled me the Madonna, I thought that was pretty hot stuff. So I bought into that. And I went around looking like one. And in fact, you're right, everybody was wearing black. But in the counterculture world, everybody was wearing black. And so I fell into that quite comfortably, having sort of been by nature a counterculture type. And I suppose in a way I still am.
Your repertoire when you started was filled with very, very serious and very tragic traditional folk ballads. And I know that some people in your audiences would actually laugh, you mentioned this in your book, because the songs were just so serious
sort of
and so sad.
Endlessly sad.
What attracted you to the material?
Pardon me?
What attracted you to that kind of material?
I think I identified with all the sort of the tragedy and so forth. And late teens, mid-teens, I was wandering around, you know, wanting to have something wonderful happen, like fall in love, and all these songs were unrequited love songs. And it was just probably one way of working out adolescence, but also they were very, very beautiful. They were long, and they were long stories, and I'd sometimes weep while I was learning them. And then the fact was that one night, sort of an awakening to me, people got the giggles in the coffee shop because it was just, there were too many sad songs in a row, and so I had to learn how to lighten up just a teensy bit.
Was that hard to do?
Well, probably for me at the beginning, yeah. I mean, people didn't know I had a sense of humor until about a week ago. No, that I was so serious on the stage. And then, see, I got serious about politics, and I really was. And I think I was afraid that if I cracked one joke from the stage, I'd think, aha, I knew she wasn't really serious about the politics. And so I was pretty serious for a long time.
You've put together a song of cliches or very serious lines from various ballads you became famous for singing. Is there any way you would sing that for us?
Oh, in Michael?
Mm-hmm.
The song Michael?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There in the night with Michael, while he lay fast asleep, I'd put my brow to the window pane, and in the fullness of love did weep. How's that?
Okay. You've referred to your Madonna virgin image when you were starting out. What kind of image was that?
Well, you know, there was an essence of purity about all the songs that I chose and the songs that attracted me. There was an essence of purity about me, in fact. I didn't take drugs. I was, when I was labeled a virgin, I still was one. I mean, I didn't last terribly long, but and the things that attracted me in life really grew out of a Quaker background and concerns with other people struggling and with suffering, and that came down from two grandfather ministers and to my father, who had rejected defense work and lots of money to remain a Quaker and a teacher and keep his, you know, his beliefs and his integrity and so on. So there was a certain element of at least attempting to be true to ourselves in our family. And then that whole basis was the foundation for my social activism and politics all through my life. So there's an element of purity. And I think then the way that got exaggerated was my own inner and not conscious, unconscious fear of commercialism and the big world of, you know, major record companies and so on. That comes out in the book about choosing a record company. I could have had the biggest and the best and the most gold albums and so on. And I didn't go that direction. I went to something more moderate and something, a classical music company, Vanguard. And I think that I'm very, very glad for those decisions. I think they were correct. But I think underlying that was a real fear that once you step into that big wicked world, you know, you'll be swallowed up and never come out alive.
You know,
which maybe has some merit, you know.
I'm thinking of all the teenage girls back in the 60s who were really dying to be you and to look like you and to sing like you. Were you aware of that, of how many people wanted to look and sound and be you?
Well, I think I was, I knew about that in a sense, but I think, again, you protect yourself from things like that because they're a little too extraordinary and they're not healthy for your equilibrium. So I think I knew more about that when I was told about it later, and I looked back on it and could see that. And of course, it's flattering, you know, it's flattering and nice in a way, but as I say, it throws you off balance.
Well, how consciously did you cultivate your image, which had such power over your listeners? By that, I mean, you know, your long hair, the kinds of colorful clothes that you'd wear.
Well, the funny thing is people established an image probably from Newport and a couple of the early pictures. And then it doesn't matter what you do, they still keep that image. I remember a woman talking to me one time. I had so much makeup on my eyes I could hardly open and close them because that was very beatnik, is to wear gobs of stuff on your eyes but no lipstick. And the word was out that Baez didn't wear makeup. And here's this interviewer saying, and it's true, you don't wear any makeup. And I was pointing to these clots on my eyelashes. And I said, but I have makeup on. She just kept saying, that's just fascinating at your age that you reject makeup. So, you know, people see what they're ready to see in a way also. The first time somebody found out that I shopped at Magnans, it was a telephone interview with this woman, and she wanted something different. You know, what do you do for a good time? And I said, well, I love to shop. And she said, for what? And I said, clothes. And she just was dead silent. And then she said, why? And I said, because I like clothes. And she said, where do you shop? And I said, oh, you know, Saks, Magnum. And she said, why? I said, oh, because I can't get to Paris every weekend. And the poor lady, number one, she didn't know I had a sense of humor. Two, she didn't know I liked nice clothes. So it was all her title was Bias Shops at Magnum. She didn't hear anything else.
So once you've had an image that's created, it's hard for people to notice when you've changed.
Yeah, Doesn't matter, you know, but there it is.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is singer and activist Joan Baez, who's written an autobiography titled A Voice to Sing With. When did you start moving your repertoire toward more contemporary and political songs?
Well, I think my courtship with ballads took maybe 2 years of my life in Cambridge in 59-60. And then as soon as I had any relationship at all with the civil rights movement, and I started that in 61, I started picking up the songs that would really be relevant in those situations. So I would start with the early songs, the spirituals, and those things could connect me with that movement. And then there was this odd situation of me being an interpretist of song. Never occurred to me to write. I probably couldn't have in those days anyway because I was convinced I couldn't. And so that when Phil Oakes wrote There But For Fortune and then Dylan began writing those real gems that he gave us, that's when some of my thoughts and feelings and activism connected with the music, 63, 64, 65.
You've, during your career, sung a lot of songs by Bob Dylan, who was your good friend and for a short time your lover. How did you meet?
Meet Bob. Somebody said, you've got to come to Greenwich Village. There's this incredible guy who writes music and et cetera, et cetera. And I had been told by a number of people the same thing, that this incredible guy was in the village. So I went to see him, and he was incredible. I mean, I was very impressed. He was this funny little guy with his guitar. The night I saw him, he was making up songs. He sang the song to Woody, and then he was just making up words, which just, I was in total awe of that, to just stand there and ad-lib and make up music. And then he was dragged over to the table to meet the Madonna, and it was all very awkward because, you know, I felt like some aging dowager at that point, and he seemed so young. And I didn't work with him for, I think, maybe a year or so after that, and we just met him that night.
Well, you were more established than he was at the time, and you took him on an American tour that you were doing and used to introduce him.
Yeah, I'd introduce him, and my audience, you know, they're trained into absolute silence to listen to the Madonna singer nubile folk songs, and on would come this little scruff ball, and he would sing, and his voice, you know, was not, they were not prepared for that, and then sometimes they would boo. And I'd shake my little finger at them like a schoolmarm and say, now you listen to this boy, he's a genius. And so they'd be quiet and obedient. And then before very long, maybe a verse or two, they'd figure out that in fact it was something quite astonishing going on with the songs he was writing.
Well, that really helped him get known. And then shortly thereafter, he went on an English tour and took you with him, except he didn't share the spotlight with you the way you had shared it with him.
That's true. I don't really enjoy telling Dylan stories over the air, but I would say that in the what I wrote about Bob, which is, I think, has surprised people because it's very candid, I open myself up. I mean, I think you learn more about me than you do about Bob, and tell the magnificence of the music and the times that we had together and really some glorious things about him. And then it's very unflattering on the dismal parts. And that was very difficult to figure out how to write that, because that, you know, he and the other people I've dealt with in the book are important to me, were important to me. And so I think you have to write some of the good and the bad. On the other hand, I don't think a book should be written to level accounts, and I really tried not to do that. I tried to just express what those times were like.
Well, let's talk about this effect on you when you were touring England with him and weren't getting called onto stage and weren't sharing the spotlight with him. How did it affect you emotionally?
Well, I would talk about that in a grander sense in general. Somebody who came into an identity at age 18, as I said, you know, and I thought it was pretty terrific to be the Madonna and got lots and lots of attention and learned to sort of survive on that. And one of the things that happened was I couldn't stand having the show stolen from me. I was very ungraceful about that, and I simply couldn't believe that that was happening. About Bob's gracelessness, people can make their own assumptions why he did what he did, but the difficulty for me was my own reaction to that, that I kept going back to it and didn't sort of, you know, didn't use my head or didn't have one in that situation.
Do you still sing songs by him?
Sure, yeah. They're marvelous. They're the best that anybody wrote, in my opinion, for the things that we needed and the things that we did in the 60s. They are really a gold mine.
You know, one thing that strikes me about your early career is that it was a combination of selflessness and ego. You know, because you seemed on stage like a very selfless person who was pouring out her heart for the larger good, and yet you get so fed by audiences that you become very ego involved with that attention.
That's absolutely true, and I wanted to do that, you know, to present that in the book in some sort of lighthearted way. And well, it's true for those of us who have almost as our partners that audience. So when people tease or accuse me of enjoying the attention, I say, yeah. I mean, when I was 15, it's written in the book, when I was 15, we found this essay I wrote called What I Believe, and among other things, it's talking about when I show off at school and I say, I'm not a saint, I'm a noise. So it was already started way back then. That's how I got my attention. We moved a lot, and I was always the new kid in the school. And though people weren't unkind to me, we always lived at the fringe. I didn't have whatever it took to sort of be instantly in the in crowd. So I was always at the edge of it. And the new kind of attention, namely people applauding and saying, "Gee whiz, you're wonderful," was I began to feed on that. And then, you know, then the part of saying that's the ego and then trying to keep my head straight or, quote, be a good person, you go back to Quaker meeting, you know, and find out, try and just keep both feet on the ground and use the entire process, people's adulation, people's response, what I do, my voice, for a common good, for something good rather than something negative.
My guest is Joan Baez. Joan, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be back in a few seconds.
Okay.
Okay. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and peace activist Joan Baez. She's written an autobiography titled And a Voice to Sing With. She's joining us today from the NPR studios in Chicago. Joan, what effect did the women's movement have on you? And let me start off by asking you about a poster that you were pictured on. It was a picture of you and your sister Mimi Farina, and there was a third woman. I forget who
she
was.
My other sister. She's my other sister.
And this was a poster about draft resistance, and the caption, the pictures of you three women, and the caption says, "Girls say yes to boys who say no."
Well, you know, the man I was living with, I don't know if I was married to him at that moment, was David Harris, who was on the forefront of the draft resistance movement, but on the back lines of women's consciousness. And I was in the back lines as well. When women came to the house, and they were absolutely furious about that poster because it was saying, "Girls, first of all, say yes, second of all." You're not supposed to say yes to anybody unless, you know, you instigate the thought, to boys who say no. And my point was, you should allow yourselves to fall in love with draft resistors rather than macho men. Their point was that they didn't like anything about the poster at all, from calling us girls to saying yes to men or to boys.
Well, it made it sound like girls are more sexually available to draft resistors.
Well, just even the fact of calling us girls instead of women. I mean, I just didn't know that. I was so into, yes, I was married. That's it. I was married, and I was having a wonderful time cooking bread and literally mopping up the house. I had this image of what being married was going to be all about. I think I was pregnant.
So you're trying to fit into a traditional...
Oh, I was fitting in.
Role.
I mean, yeah. And I thought that was, I mean, in the book, it says how at one point I had these, for years, I had these fantasies of being married and there'd be children tumbling all over the floor and riding St. Bernards around and I'm cooking stew over an open fire, etc. Which, as it turned out, was just totally not in my script. I'm not any good at being married, you know. But anyway, the first question you had about these women came to the house and were just furious about that poster. I honestly didn't know what they were talking about, and I just kept offering them sandwiches, which made them even angrier because that was being in the old-fashioned woman's role.
Well, did feminism change you at any point?
Well, I'm sure feminism has affected me, and it's affected everybody. I'm not a feminist. In the same sense, I think that during the black movement, the movement in the South, I never felt black power. And during when I worked with Cesar Chavez, I never felt brown power. I don't feel woman power. I feel people power. And I feel that that's terribly important. I can understand how people coming out of their own experiences will have a priority of their own. And for many women, that is women's consciousness. And for me, it never has been, so it would be phony to pretend it has. But it doesn't mean I can't look at it rationally, see that it's important, women's rights are important, and take my role in that, whatever it might be.
You know, I want to ask you about cutting your hair. But
you can hit the heavy stuff today.
Yeah,
huh?
No, but not
this
in
is
all
NPR. I forgot.
But not in a fashion kind of way. Here's what I'm interested in. I think that you represented for so many people a kind of Earth Mother type figure, a politically active Earth Mother with long tresses, an almost goddess up there on the stage. And to me, when you cut it, it was almost saying, "Well, I don't have to be that, and that women don't have to be that." But I don't know if that was going through your mind at all.
Well,
maybe it was just hard to dry. I don't know.
I was pregnant. That's what happens. I mean, I think when people get pregnant, they do all sorts of wonderful new things. You know, I took two Valium and went to the hairdresser and said, "Get rid of this stuff." and I was a nervous wreck, but it was shedding an image, and I wanted to feel fresh and new and pregnant and all the, you know, things I hadn't been before. And I didn't give a damn about losing my hair. That was, at that point, everybody else's problem and not mine.
Yeah, but people really had a problem with it, right?
Well, there was something for them to learn then.
Did it say anything to you about what was expected of you or of your female image when you saw the reaction to cutting your hair?
Well, no, not the female image. What about the rebel? You know, how come we can see your face now and it has makeup all over it kind of thing? But really and truly, it was not my problem. I had a wonderful time with my new haircut, and I still do.
You've sung at political rallies around the world. Can you remember for us one of the times when you were on stage during a political demonstration, when you really felt that the power of singing had a profound effect on the people who had gathered there?
Yeah, I can name two times right off the bat. One would be Hanoi in 1972, when I happened to be visiting Vietnamese people and delivering mail to POWs, and we got caught in a 11-day bombing raid. And this wasn't to a large audience. It was just to bomb shelters full of people. And all of us, as soon as I could sing, because I was so scared that I could barely breathe, and as soon as I could sing, I started singing, and everybody would ask for me to sing again when the bombing would get terrible. It just did something to our spirits. And another time when it really unified people, I think, was 1963, Birmingham, Alabama, at Miles College, the first integrated concert on that campus ever. I sang at a black school, because the only way I could integrate an audience was to sing on a black campus, because the blacks didn't know who I was. And so some of them would come to their own function, you know, just out of boredom. And then whites would come onto the campus, and it's absolutely terrifying because everybody was, you know, scared of a bomb going off somewhere because we were integrated. And then at the end of that concert, everybody stood up and sang We Shall Overcome. And that is including rednecks and people who claimed that they just came because they were reporters. And we all were crying and we all were singing. And it really was a mighty day.
When the folk revival died down, did you feel like your audience had deserted you?
Well, you know, it's 1980 what now? 87.
Seven.
Yes. No, I have this marvelous audience that stays with me. Now, that's different in different countries. In Europe, say Latin America, probably Africa, Spain, and so on, my audiences are much younger, and I'm not sure why. I think it has to do with political atmosphere and social atmosphere, and they're deeper rooted and broader and can accept a wider range of things, and they're not as faddish as we are in the States. But it's an extraordinary phenomenon for me to be able to go on singing and recruiting people who are, in fact, interested in somebody who sings melody, sings words, will deal with topics of the time. I'm a little easier now because I do have a sense of humor on the stage. You know, but that, of course, things change. You know, it's been 28 years, and things are bound to change. Not only change, but they changed about 180 degrees from long contemplative ballads and introspection and Small is Beautiful and earth music to cosmos, the beat, no emphasis on words. It's been a huge change, and I've had to simply forge my way through that. And as you may or may not know, there'd been an 8-year break between records, and I now finally have one with which I am ecstatically happy, because it just seemed to take that time for the right company, for me to find the right company and us to work together and make music.
For years, you were a symbol of the youth movement, the youth counterculture, the youth political movement. Was it hard for you to accept being older after years of symbolizing young activism?
Well, you can leave off the second half of that sentence. Everybody has to deal with the years as they pass. One of the things that was very helpful to me, and I think I suspected that would happen in writing this book, it took 3 years. I started it 3 years ago. I'm looking for patience. You know, I'm looking for my way of dealing with not only the next 45 years, but now. I hope at the end of the chapter on Martin Luther King, I express how jealous I am of him when he said, I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land. What he was saying was number one, I'm not afraid of death anymore. Number two, I know exactly what I'm doing. Well, I would like to not be afraid of death or middle age or being older than middle age, etc. I'd like to not be preoccupied with all that. I would like to find how do I do God's will and do it the best and share myself intelligently with the rest of the human race until I die? And so those are things that I was trying to work out through writing the book and a little bit through making the album.
You took voice lessons not too long ago. I don't know if you're still taking them.
Yeah, I'll have to take them until I stop singing now.
What has the voice lessons taught you about your voice and your singing?
Well, they taught me that I had a natural talent from probably age 13, and that when you're young, you're elastic and everything works and you don't have to do much about it, you know, Becker. And then that when I went to see this man, it took me 4 years to get to a voice coach because it didn't dawn on me that coughing and hacking and having trouble with high notes was a reality. And when it finally it dawned on me, I went to get help, and this man said something very funny. He said, didn't anybody ever tell you that when you get around 40, gravity takes over everything? And I said, oh, thanks a lot, Charlie. But he said, if you really want those pipes to be in terrific condition, you'll have to work with them every day of your life, with a few exceptions from now until you quit singing. So when I accepted that and began working with it, we've really changed the whole structure of throat and chest and breathing and all those things I'd never thought about. And it's been, I really consider my voice to be in its second prime.
It's changed the mechanics of your singing. Do you think it's changed the sound of your voice?
Well, it has some, but the sound of your voice changes anyway. It deepens. And so what's happened is that though I would never be able to sing the high, high Barbara Allen in that very light soprano again, I can sing it in a different soprano, and I can sing in a much richer lower voice and have more fun with it because I feel more secure.
Okay, well, Joan Baez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been singer Joan Baez, and she's written an autobiography titled And a Voice to Sing With. It's just been published by Summit Books. She has a new record titled Recently that will be released next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.